I'm Anne Strainchamps. Conspiracy theories are like mushrooms. They pop up everywhere, from celebrity Twitter feeds to the campaign trail. They can be crazy, hilarious, weirdly convincing. And today we're going to make the case that even the most wacko conspiracy theories are actually worth taking seriously. To explain why, here's Steve Paulson talking with Jesse Walker, author of The United States of Paranoia.
Jesse, we tend to think of conspiracy theories as being ideas that a small group of people on the fringes of society believe. Is that really the case?
It is, among other things, a set of ideas that people on the fringes of society believe. But it's also a set of ideas that people at the center of society have believed going back from the colonial era till today. American conspiracy theories are at the core of American history. And whether you're looking at the Revolution, the Civil War, the War on Terror, the Indian Wars, the labor battles of the late 19th century, conspiracy theories are a big part of the story on all sides.
And that's interesting because I think there is this sense that that right now we're living kind of in this golden age of conspiracy theories. It may be because it's the internet and, you know, they can circulate so easily. But you're saying they've always been around.
Yeah. And in fact, it's not at all clear to me that there's more of them now than there were, you know, 20 years ago, 40 years ago. A couple of political scientists, Joe Yusinski and Joe Parente, just did a study a year or two ago where they went through letters to the editor of the New York Times and as sort of a control group, the Chicago Tribune, tons of these from the 1890s to today, and categorized, you know, which made conspiratorial claims of any kind. And they had like a big spike in the 1890s with people talking about the trusts, and they had a big spike in the 1950s because of people talking about communist conspiracies. And there's smaller spikes like around Watergate. But generally, the trend, when you sort of average away those spikes, has been flat and, in fact, slightly declining over the years. You can make claims that, you know, maybe it migrated to other places like, you know, talk radio, the internet. I don't think that's completely dispositive, but it really illustrates how much this is just a constant part of American life. It's not just that people can see things now on the internet that might maybe were more invisible in the past. It's that people forget the anxieties of the past. You know, your big apocalyptic fear of what was about to happen. If it doesn't happen, you kind of set aside that you were worried about that. Who thinks about Y2K nowadays, you know? Yeah. And Y2K, actually, I say that and people will know what I'm talking about. But there are other moments like that that people almost entirely forget. So there's this tendency to magnify the fears of the moment and to play down the fears of the past.
And a lot of this paranoia gets played out in politics. And we seem to be seeing that right now, for instance. In particular, Donald Trump would seem to be a big purveyor of, whether you want to call them conspiracy theories or paranoia. I mean, the Obama birther question, you know, is he really an American citizen? And you could make the case that's part of his appeal.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't think Donald Trump is in any sense the only politician who does this. But it's really interesting to look at his particular set of conspiracy beliefs, because they say a lot about not just his appeal, but I mean, his whole persona. While this guy has been flirting with politics since the 1980s, he really kind of made his current entrance onto the stage in 2011, right, with the birth certificate stuff. Mm-hmm. And birtherism, think about what birtherism embodies. I mean, for one thing, obviously, there's this fear of foreign influence. You know, what if the person running the country really isn't an American? You know, that obviously speaks to the sort of fears of Mexican and Muslim subversion that are part of the Trump campaign. But also, and I make this argument in my book, I think that birtherism in a weird way reflects a kind of excessive reverence for the presidency. It's kind of the flip side of, you know, the fervent fan base that Obama has, because this is a way to keep your respect for the Oval Office intact while still hating the man who occupies it.
The argument is he's illegitimate. I mean, he's not a real president.
He's a pretender to the throne. I mean, you often hear these sort of royalist metaphors. And that also kind of speaks to what Donald Trump represents. I mean, in terms of, you know, the conflicts on the right that are happening right now, he is not a man who's interested in, you know, limited government or anything like that. He has this great man appeal. You know, you put me in charge, I will make the right deals. I'll be the guy who can bring in the right top men and fix all these problems.
But you're saying that Trump isn't the only candidate out there who traffics in conspiracy theories.
No, I mean, I mean, they all do in different ways. I mean, Hillary Clinton, you know, famously blamed her husband's trouble on a vast right-wing conspiracy 20 years ago. Every political faction is afraid of somebody, and that always, at least among some members of that faction, will manifest itself as one or more conspiracy theory.
Hmm. Now, to some degree, when we talk about paranoia in politics, it goes back to 1964, when the famous historian Richard Hofstadter delivered a lecture in England called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. In fact, that was...
Actually, let me give you a slight correction there. His essay was published in 64. He gave the lecture in 63, the day before Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, that's right.
So that's like the great dual birthplace
right.
of the way people talk about conspiracy theories today.
Yeah. So that essay that he wrote was very influential. It seemed to shape the way we think about paranoia and politics. Why?
It's interesting because if you look at, you know, the scholarly literature, I mean, especially history and, you know, American studies, and people were sort of in the region that Hofstadter was writing in. And there's been all sorts of critiques of Hofstadter, and a lot of the stuff he said there is considered old hat or wrong. But at the same time, that particular essay is the one that keeps getting name-checked and not always read, but, you know, and read. It's interesting because it's got genuine insights in it, and I discuss them in the book, but I think it gets some important things wrong. I think that in particular, he has the line in there about it, the paranoid style being an approach for minority movements. And I don't accept that at all. And, you know, maybe sometimes they'll see society at large, but that's just a brief interval. And the examples he mentions, with one exception, they're coming from the fringes of society.
Like the John Birch Society and these kinds of fringe groups.
And the historical examples and anti-Masonic and anti-Catholic fears and so on. But at every sort of moment where you can look at people on the outskirts of the centers of power having conspiracy theories about the people in charge, you can then turn it around and see the people that they have conspiracy theories about also having conspiracy theories about the opposition, the outsiders. The Populist Party famously had all these conspiracy theories about Eastern bankers and so forth, sometimes, not always, but sometimes with a sort of anti-Semitic tinge to it. The flip side is a lot of the people, powerful Eastern establishment types, were ruminating about, is populism the product of a foreign conspiracy? I found this wonderful series of really bizarre articles in one newspaper about a sort of proto-populist group, this alleged expose about the anarchist secret society that was, you know, pulling the strings. Or, you know, slaves had all these conspiracy theories about their masters, but at the same time, the slave owners were in constant fear of slave revolts to the point where if they saw two slaves talking and they didn't know what it was about, you might have a revolt panic. The idea that they were out there conspiring to bring down the social order. This happens again and again. And this is another thing that sort of, I mentioned that forgetting earlier in the interview.
Mm-hmm.
People forget the conspiracy theories that seize the mainstream. It wasn't that long ago that major media outlets, you know, politicians, prosecutors, juries, were seriously believing the idea that a network of satanic cults was not just existing in America, but going through this ritual molestation of children, even kidnapping and killing kids, although the bodies never turned up.
All right. That was, two or three decades ago.
1980s and the early 90s, right? And there's, you know, people remaining in jail for a long time afterwards, even after the panic subsided. This was not just a fringe thing. Some of these beliefs had been out on the sort of the fringes of the Christian right in the 70s. And some of those fringe figures, you know, in the 70s who were falsely claiming to be, you know, defectors from the Illuminati and they knew the score, you know, were actually being interviewed on places like 2020 in the 80s as experts. But, you know, yeah, it's, suddenly you have places like 2020 running these reports with, in the case of that one, you know, no skeptical voices at all. You know, Geraldo had several specials on this. And then it all goes away. You know, it's sort of remembered, but people don't bring that up usually when they list conspiracy theories and they fall back on their Hofstadter and their idea that this is just, you know, a fringe phenomenon, and it's not.
And yet, on the other hand, occasionally some of these conspiracy theories turn out to be right.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back to the 60s. You know, the radical black activists, especially the Black Panthers, you know, there was this widespread suspicion that the FBI was trying to smear them or frame them for certain crimes. And it turns out a lot of those fears were right.
Yeah. In fact, this is another one of those Hall of Mirrors moments, because the heart of that, it was the COINTEL program of the FBI, which was not just aimed at infiltrating dissident groups, but at spreading fear within those groups, making people suspect one another of being police agents. And it was essentially a conspiracy to make people fear that they were being conspired against. And a very effective one. I mean, it ripped apart a lot of organizations. And not just that, it was a conspiracy driven by the fear that these groups were themselves, agents of a foreign conspiracy, that the civil rights movement was being manipulated by Moscow and things like that. So in a sense, COINTELPRO was a conspiracy to defeat alleged subversive conspiracies by convincing the conspirators they were being conspired against. So it gets very complicated. But yes, it's absolutely true that conspiracies really happen. There's a whole chapter in this book which talks about the revelations that happened in the 1970s when things like COINTELPRO or the CIA's Operation Chaos and just Watergate, and politically motivated IRS audits and, NSA surveillance were revealed both by the press and by, the Church Committee and the Senate and reputable sources, such that, it was clear that this stuff was going on, and how that in turn affected the additional fears that people were willing to engage in and the sorts of fears that people were willing to bring into popular culture.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Jesse Walker, author of The United States of Paranoia,